Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Why Preventing Terror Attacks Like Manchester is So Difficult, by Jennifer Kalfas. The suicide bombing attack at Ariana Grande's concert in Manchester on Monday renewed fears about how to keep soft targets like stadiums and airports safe, and exposed just how difficult it is to protect them from terrorism. Security experts, who have time and time again responded with new measures as a result of specific but rare attacks around the world, say that protecting outside areas around concert or sport venues like the Manchester Arena poses many challenges. While there are security checkpoints upon entering a venue, those can create long lines that can be easily targeted. And while many venues have expansive security perimeters outside of the building, it's difficult to determine where that boundary should begin. The challenge is to continue to integrate layers of security that will be effective against this kind of threat, said Bennett Waters, a counterterrorism expert at the Chertoff Group who used to work at the Department of Homeland Security. We can't have all the security all the time. The Manchester terrorist attack, for which ISIS has claimed responsibility, unfolded Monday night when swells of concertgoers were leaving Grande's performance, creating a soft target for the suspected suicide bomber, Salman Abedi. The explosion outside the arena killed at least 22 people, including young children, and injured dozens. The devastating event echoed the 2015 attacks in Paris, where 130 people were killed in a series of coordinated incidents, including when gunmen fired into a packed Bataclan concert hall during a show. In the same wave of attacks, security personnel stopped a bomber from entering a Paris soccer stadium, and he then detonated explosives outside of the venue. But the problem with these soft target attacks is that there's no standard protocol in creating perimeters outside venues, which makes preventing events like Manchester all the more challenging, experts said. And how experts determine specific ways to thwart terror attacks like the truck rampage in Nice last year is different from how they approach incidents like the 2001 failed shoe bombing. The latter prompted the current policy in the U.S. requiring flyers to remove their shoes when going through airport security. Pinpointing a specific security perimeter at a sports stadium and concert venue would be difficult and could prompt other safety issues caused by long lines that can create a target-rich environment, said Steve Edelman, a venue safety expert who runs Edelman Law Group. Some major cities in the U.S., including New York City and Los Angeles, are already announcing heightened security measures in response to the Manchester attack. A representative from the United Center in Chicago, where the NBA Chicago Bulls and NHL Chicago Blackhawks play, said it's working with security experts to protect our guests inside and outside of the facilities. And it's still unclear what kind of effect the Manchester attack will have on some of the largest U.S. concert venues, like the Staples Center in Los Angeles and Barclays Center in Brooklyn, which did not immediately respond to requests for comment. But experts do think the events in Manchester will have an impact on protocols and tactics moving forward. One of the tangible results of the unfortunate situation of something like this happening is that, in general, all of us have some kind of awareness of our own personal security, said Russ Simmons, managing partner of Venue Solutions Group. If you see something, say something is not just a catchphrase.
The DJI Spark is the first drone I actually want to buy, by Alex Fitzpatrick. DJI on Wednesday unveiled the Spark drone, the smallest model the popular Chinese drone maker has released to date. A first for DJI, the Spark can be controlled entirely through hand gestures for quick airborne selfies. Piloting it with an accompanied app allows for a broader array of maneuvers, including flight patterns like Helix, which mimics Hollywood-style action movie helicopter shots. An optional remote control adds further control options and dramatically increases the range. Like other recent DJI drones, the Spark is capable of detecting and avoiding objects in its flight path. When it comes time to land, tapping the Spark's return to home button brings the aircraft back to its departure point. The Spark's camera can shoot 12-megapixel photos and record 1080p high-def videos. That's roughly equivalent to a typical smartphone, but it's not as good as DJI's higher-end drones, which can shoot ultra-high-def 4K footage. The Spark also has a shallow focus setting that blurs out the backgrounds behind your subjects, similar to the iPhone 7 Plus's portrait mode. DJI claims the Spark has up to 16 minutes of battery life. It's rechargeable via micro USB, meaning you'll be able to top it off in the field with a portable charger, provided it's big enough. The Spark is compatible with DJI goggles headwear for flying with a first-person view from the aircraft. The Spark is available for pre-order starting immediately. Shipments will begin in mid-June. It will cost $499 for the basic package, while a more extensive bundle with a second battery, remote, bag, and other extras will go for $699. I haven't had the chance to fly the Spark yet, but the specs are certainly promising. I've avoided buying a drone so far because they're either too big and cumbersome, too expensive, or from some no-name brand. But the Spark might hit the sweet spot, offering a portable design for half the cost of DJI's high-end Mavic Pro from a company that is widely considered the best in the biz.
Why the Manchester attack was an attack on girlhood, by Charlotte Alter. Terror attacks are intended to sow fear far beyond where they happen, to force people to think twice about doing what was once routine. But the places terrorists choose to strike can have specific meaning, too. The symbolic landmarks targeted on 9/11, the cosmopolitan culture of Paris's 10th and 11th arrondissement. Now that grim list includes a concert hall in Manchester, filled with young girls with cat ears stretched across their heads. Much is still unknown about the terrorist attack at the Ariana Grande concert Monday that killed 22 people and maimed dozens of others. But one thing is clear. The suicide mission, for which ISIS claimed responsibility, was also an attack on girlhood. It was a blow delivered at a moment of budding independence to young girls taking their first carefree steps towards becoming empowered women. Music is one of the first ways that kids seek to express themselves in ways that is not directly related to their parents, says Caitlin White, managing editor of music for UpRocks. It is one of the first acts of yourself, and being able to share that self with your friends, you are creating a social experience that's outside of your family for the first time. To legions of young girls, Grande is a cultural idol, one that they look up to just as they're deciding what kind of women they'll become. The former Nickelodeon star may now sell out arenas and wear skimpy clothes. Her sexually empowered new album and tour is titled Dangerous Woman, but she still sports a ponytail and playful cat ears. She doesn't have a rap sheet or rehab stint to her name. She's a bridge between the comfort of youth and the excitement of adolescence. She feels a little safer than Rihanna or Beyoncé, says Maria Sherman, a writer who studies teen fan culture. Ariana Grande is still in that crucial demographic of young women just entering an adolescent space. The casualties of Monday's attack reflect this cruel reality. 12 children under the age of 16 were wounded, and the fatalities identified so far include 18-year-old Georgina Callender and 8-year-old Safi Rose Russo's. That hideous toll includes young fans for whom Monday's concert was a milestone as much as a show, a step in their transition from impressionable girls to independent women, the kind of women who decide what music they like, who go out alone, who make money, who use it to buy concert tickets. As the writer and director Ava DuVernay put on Twitter, "Remember the thrill of your very first concert? The buzz of the crowd, the music loud, a place to trust, to be free. Not this. Hashtag Manchester." These were precocious girls on their way to becoming dangerous women. Exactly the kind of women ISIS hates.
Nail art fidget spinners that actually spin will make you question everything, by Ryan Kilpatrick. Fidget spinners, the latest toy craze to sweep the globe, have been taken to a bold new level. A fingernail decoration that actually spins. In a do-it-yourself tutorial uploaded to YouTube, makeup and nail art expert Natasha Lee shows the world how to create a miniature version of the toy out of softened acrylic and then pin it to your nail. Not only does the mini fidget spinner spin, it even glows thanks to a backlight reactive UV top coat. I couldn't resist joining in with the fidget spinner craze, Lee said on her YouTube page. The science is still out on whether fidget spinners, as claimed, offer therapeutic benefits for people with ADHD, ADD, anxiety, and stress. Parents and teachers have complained that the toy is too distracting, and some schools have banned them from classrooms. But the spinner's popularity is showing no signs of waning. The finger spinner may be over the top, but the creation sure is ingenious. The 7 Best Moisturizers with Sunscreen by Julia Naftalin from Health.com. On the hunt for the perfect daily moisturizer that hydrates skin and delivers sun protection, the Environmental Working Group, EWG, recently released its annual ranking of the best sunscreen products in different categories, including their favorite moisturizers with SPF. The EWG prioritizes mineral sunscreen ingredients over chemical ones in their annual ranking, so if that's important to you too, any of their top picks would be a good choice for your everyday skincare routine. Sonia Lunder, a senior analyst at the EWG, spoke to Health about the group's process for ranking each product. First, we determine the estimated sun protection by looking at the active ingredients, she says. Lunder explains that this helps them predict how well the formula will protect you from the sun's harmful UV rays, which can increase your risk of skin cancer. The second step involves analyzing each product's inactive ingredients. Finally, the EWG rates each product on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being best. Here are 7 moisturizers with SPF that the EWG gave a top 1 ranking. For the full list, you can go to EWG.org. Number 1. Juice Beauty Oil-Free Moisturizer SPF 30. This lightweight antioxidant-packed moisturizer contains grapes, pomegranate, aloe vera, and sea algae to soothe and hydrate skin while simultaneously delivering SPF protection. Also good? It's designed with acne-prone skin in mind, so you don't have to worry about it causing breakouts. $29. Number 2. Loving Naturals Daily UV Cream SPF 20. Fans of this unscented moisturizer say it absorbs beautifully into your skin, so you can apply it right before your makeup. The non-greasy formula dries clear, so you'll never experience annoying white streaks. $18. Number 3. Sanri Organic Skin Food Sparkling Aloe Solar Aloe Vera Day Cream SPF 30. That was a mouthful. No highlighter necessary. Organic jojoba, sunflower, and hazelnut oils replenish skin's moisture for a luminous complexion. $30. Number 4. Suntegrity Skincare 5-in-1 Natural Moisturizing Face Sunscreen Tinted with SPF 30. Your average BB cream gets an upgrade in this Suntegrity Tinted Moisturizer, which also contains sunscreen. Reviewers describe the consistency as light and non-greasy. $45. Number 5. Cetaphil Redness Relieving Daily Facial Moisturizer, SPF 20. It's no surprise that this classic dermatologist-loved skincare brand made EWG's list. The moisturizer has a light tint to balance out any redness, while SPF 20 protects from the sun. $16. Number 6. Andalou Naturals 1000 Roses CC Color Plus Correct Sheer Tan SPF 30. Want to skip a step in your makeup routine? I sure do. This CC cream, which is short for Color Correcting Cream, but you knew that, combines light-tinted coverage with UVA-UVB sun protection. $14. Number 7. Carry Grand 365 SPF 28. Red raspberry seed, French plum seed, macadamia nut seed, and avocado oil give this moisturizer a luxurious scent and feel. $75.
World Health Organization elects a new director general from Ethiopia. This article posted by Alexandra Sifferlin. On Tuesday, the World Health Organization, WHO, announced that Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, a health expert from Ethiopia, was elected as the new director general to lead the United Nations agency focused on international public health. Tedros, who prefers to be called by his first name, will be taking over the position from Dr. Margaret Chan, who has been overseeing the agency since 2006. Tedros will serve a 5-year term in the new position, which will begin on July 1st. He will be the first health official from Africa to serve as director general. In a speech before the election, part of a week-long meeting of health ministers from 194 nations in Geneva, Tedros talked about growing up in Ethiopia, saying he comes from a background of knowing survival cannot be taken for granted and refusing to accept that people should die because they are poor. Tedros also spoke about the need for universal access to healthcare, a better response to health emergencies, and the need to tackle gender-based violence, as well as threats to global health like climate change, the migrant crisis, and terrorism. The other two candidates were Britain's Dr. David Nabarro, a health official who has led the United Nations response to a variety of health problems, including the 2014 Ebola outbreak, and Dr. Sania Nishtar, the first female cardiologist in Pakistan. Tedros is a former health and foreign affairs minister from Ethiopia. As a foreign affairs minister, Tedros focused on accelerating Africa's economic, political, and social development. According to his director general application, as health minister, he oversaw the creation of 3,500 health centers and 16,000 health posts, which contributed to considerably cutting child mortality rates, HIV infections, malaria deaths, and deaths from tuberculosis. I envision a world where everyone can lead healthy and productive lives, regardless of who they are or where they live, Tedros wrote in his WHO application. Achieving this will require a stronger and reformed WHO that belongs to all of us equally and that is efficiently managed, adequately resourced, and results-driven, with a strong focus on transparency, accountability, and value for money. The WHO election comes at a difficult time in public and global health. The WHO's reputation suffered due to its response to the Ebola outbreak that started in 2014. Critics argued the organization was too slow in responding to the outbreak, which infected more than 28,000 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and killed more than 11,000. Just a couple years after the start of the epidemic, the Zika virus swept through South America and beyond, resulting in thousands of cases of the severe birth defect microcephaly among infants. As Time recently reported, the organization is not yet ready to take on another epidemic of similar proportions. The organization has an annual budget of about $2.2 billion, which is less than major hospitals, the New York Times reports. 30% of that budget comes from United Nations dues, and the rest comes from donated funds. Tedros is an excellent choice to lead WHO, said Dr. Tom Frieden, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in an email sent to Time. He succeeded in Ethiopia, making remarkable health progress by rapidly reforming a sclerotic bureaucracy and implementing effective community-based services. Precisely the same thing is needed to make WHO effective, providing technical guidance and improving support to countries. Governments and organizations around the world should support WHO to become more effective. Doing so is in all of our best interest. Yet the campaign was not without controversy. An informal advisor for rival candidate David Nabarro accused of covering up 3 cholera epidemics in his country of Ethiopia, where he served as health minister. Lawrence Gostin, the director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University, told the New York Times, "Dr. Tedros is a compassionate and highly competent public health official, but he had a duty to speak truth to power and to honestly identify and report verified cholera outbreaks over an extended period." Tedros denies the allegation and told the Times that Nabarro's supporters have a typical colonial mindset aimed at winning at any cost and discrediting a candidate from a developing country. Frieden wrote an opinion letter to the Times defending Tedros. Although not optimal, many countries report cholera to the World Health Organization as acute watery diarrhea, as Ethiopia has, he wrote. This allows reporting and response without laboratory confirmation, but in no way indicates that Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, a former health minister of Ethiopia, is any less qualified to become director general of the WHO.
Wendy Davis, Texas lawmakers are bullying transgender youth, by Wendy Davis. Just a couple of weeks ago, as the Texas legislature entered the final days of its legislative session, House lawmakers from both sides of the aisle came together tearfully to pledge their support for David's Law, a bill that addresses cyberbullying. Named for a San Antonio teen who took his own life after being bullied, the law would require public schools to establish cyberbullying policies and systems for anonymous reports. As Republican State Representative Wayne Faircloth said, speaking in favor of the bill, "It is time to treat each other with respect, and that starts here in this House. We have to set the example here. It's how we treat each other. It's how we walk. It's how we talk. It's how we listen, to seek, to understand, to make a difference." Just 10 days later, some of those very same lawmakers became the bullies. Their victims? Transgender students in our public school system. This was accomplished by adding language to an amendment to Senate Bill 2078, which focuses on school districts' multi-hazard emergency operations plans. The legislation would add bathroom restrictions that keep transgender students from using school restrooms that match their gender identity, a stated Republican priority. Never mind the highly questionable ruling allowing the amendment to attach to SB 2078. How is this proposal in any way related to addressing a public school's multi-hazard emergency operations plan? The law reopens Jim Crow-era wounds through an arguably separate but equal standard by requiring a transgender student who does not wish to use a facility based on biological sex to use single-stall restrooms, locker rooms, and changing spaces at school. Democratic State Representative Sanfronia Thompson, an African-American woman, poignantly hammered that point home. "White, colored. I was living through that era. Bathrooms divided us then, and it divides us now. America has long recognized that separate but equal is not equal at all." Laughably, Republicans argue that the legislation was not intended to target transgender students. Not so laughably, Republicans seem to have forgotten their own admonition about how we treat each other just a few short days ago. Like many Texans, I find myself utterly at a loss as I track the actions of my former colleagues. Very real challenges faced them when this legislative session began. Real harms to real people presented themselves and were ignored or made worse. And instead of focusing on those pressing issues, Republican lawmakers chose to feed the insatiable desire of their right-wing voting base, concentrating on manufactured problems and offering constitutionally suspect solutions to them. Repeatedly, Republican-led Texas has been hauled into court and told that it has overstepped its constitutional bounds. It happened last summer when the U.S. Supreme Court smacked down the anti-abortion law that Republican lawmakers passed in the name of keeping women safe and that had resulted in the endangerment of women who could no longer access safe legal abortion. It happened less than 2 years ago when a federal judge found that Texas's foster care system violates children's rights, noting years of abuse and neglect within the system. And it has happened multiple times in recent years as federal courts have struck down Texas's voter ID laws and redistricting maps, finding them to be intentionally discriminatory. Rather than working to protect the state's children, who need lawmakers to address urgent problems ranging from a broken foster care system to an alarmingly high incidence of sex trafficking of minors to dramatically underfunded public schools, the legislature chose instead to aim its firepower at some of its most vulnerable citizens, transgender youth. I can think of no better commentary on this travesty than to repeat Representative Faircloth's words, "It is time to treat each other with respect. We have to set the example." I'm not proud of the example I see my state setting right now. Their actions won't go unchallenged, and like so many of their past ill-motivated laws, I pray that they won't survive. In the meantime, though, their damage will be felt, and that's the difference they will make. Wendy Davis is a former Texas state senator and the founder of Deeds, Not Words. Microsoft just unveiled a faster Surface Pro tablet by Lisa Iadicio. Microsoft unveiled its latest Surface Pro, which it says offers faster performance, longer battery life, and an improved design over the Surface Pro 4. The new Surface Pro will be available on June 15th, starting at $799. An LTE version will also be available. Microsoft says the new Surface Pro is 20% faster than the old Surface Pro 4. The company is also claiming 13.5 hours of battery life on a single charge, a 50% increase over the Surface Pro 4. That's also longer than the 12 hours Apple claims for its MacBook Air. Microsoft's Surface Pen Stylus is getting some improvements as well, including more precise pressure sensitivity and a new tilt mode for shading. Microsoft also says the ink is more responsive to movement, so people who use the tablet for quick sketches or jotting down notes shouldn't experience any lag. The updated tablet, which Microsoft is simply calling the new Surface Pro rather than sticking with its numerical sequence, will be available in Core i7, Core i5, and Core M variants. Like the Pro 4, it offers USB 3.0 ports rather than the USB-C connectivity. That means it'll work with older accessories, but could be problematic as gadget makers shift to the new speedier USB-C standard. Some of Microsoft's design choices with the new tablet are a sign that the company is aiming the device at the professional, creative, and educational world. It's compatible with the new Surface Dial, for instance, an accessory aimed at the artistic set. The kickstand has been redesigned so the tablet can lay nearly flat, which creative types may find useful. It also resembles Microsoft's artsy Surface Studio all-in-one computer that was unveiled last October. Furthermore, Microsoft is updating workplace software like Word, Excel, and PowerPoint to better integrate with the Surface Pen, which office workers may find useful. The new Surface Pro comes just weeks after Microsoft unveiled its new Surface Laptop, a device the company is primarily marketing towards students, but could be a worthy competitor to Apple's MacBook Air lineup. Still, Microsoft's announcement comes as the overall tablet market is in a free fall. Shipments of the devices have declined for 9 consecutive quarters as of the end of 2016, according to research firm IDC. That may explain why Microsoft is pitching its new Surface products towards students and creative professionals, two groups that have a clear use for tablets. But it's unclear if the new Surface Pro will be enough to revitalize Microsoft's Surface business, where revenue recently dropped by 26% compared to the year-ago quarter. Trump's new budget plan guts Medicaid. Here's what you need to know. By Alicia Adamczyk. The Trump administration's 2018 budget request, unveiled Tuesday, includes deep cuts to Medicaid, the insurance program for low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. Medicaid covers nearly 1 in 4 Americans and accounts for $1 out of every 6 spent on health care in the country. The budget outline assumes that the American Health Care Act, the Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act, will take effect in its current form. That's far from assured, but if it does, Medicaid funding will be slashed by around $839 billion over the next decade, as payments to the states would be capped and eligibility would be narrowed. But the budget proposal, which Congress still has to approve, assumes an additional $610 billion in Medicaid cuts because it allows states to restructure their Medicaid programs by switching to per capita caps, a set amount of money per enrollee per year, or block grants, a set amount of money each state would receive from the federal government each year. Currently, Medicaid will cover all the costs necessary to provide coverage to everyone who is eligible. There are no caps in spending. According to Lauren Adler, Associate Director of the Schaefer Initiative for Innovation in Health Policy, the cuts equate to almost half of Medicaid's funding over the next decade. What Medicaid does? As Money has outlined before, the cuts put coverage for 74 million Americans at risk. Switching Medicaid to a per capita system or block grant would likely mean that fewer people would be covered, and benefits would be cut, Experts say there simply would be less money to go around. And the proposal notes that the states would be able to institute guidelines that require work promoting personal responsibility, which would also likely lead to coverage loss, as some current enrollees wouldn't meet whatever new requirements the states come up with. But Medicaid reaches far beyond able-bodied adults out of work, despite the proposal's rhetoric. The elderly and disabled account for around 60% of Medicaid's expenditures, with the disabled, including the mentally ill, accounting for a full 42% of spending. The program is the country's largest funder of long-term care expenses, covering 40% of the costs, as well as more than 60% of all nursing home residents. For baby boomers nearing or past retirement age, these funds are crucial. As Money has previously reported, nursing homes for the elderly cost an average of $80,000 annually, and those expenditures aren't covered under Medicare, the health program for seniors over 65. In fact, because Medicaid absorbs high health care costs of people with expensive conditions like dementia, it has kept private insurance around 7% lower than they would be. Slashing funds also disproportionately affects women and children. One half of births in the U.S. are covered by Medicaid. That varies widely by state. In Louisiana, 65% of births are covered by Medicaid, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which covered more than 8.4 million children in 2015, would also see its budget significantly reduced, according to Joan Alker, executive director of the Georgetown Center for Children and Families. Medicaid also provides essential health coverage for low-income women, particularly women and children of color. Also, because the ACA allowed states to expand Medicaid eligibility, millions of people qualified for health coverage. In fact, the Medicaid expansion accounts for the majority of the health insurance gains made since Obama's health law went into effect. If the proposed budget and the AHCA were to pass as they are, millions of people could potentially lose coverage over the next decade. Other health care cuts. The proposed budget does not allow reimbursements to organizations that provide abortions, like Planned Parenthood, and severely cuts funding for science and public health agencies, including a $1 billion cut to the National Cancer Institute. Notably, the National Institute of Health's budget would be slashed from $31.8 billion to $26 billion. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention would face cuts of more than $1 billion, including a $222 million decrease in funding to the chronic disease prevention programs, which help people with conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. The National Science Foundation would face a decrease of $776 million. President Trump's budget includes a $2 trillion math mistake. By Ryan Teague Beckwith. President Trump's budget includes a simple accounting error that adds up to a $2 trillion oversight. Under the proposed budget released Tuesday, the Trump administration's proposed tax cuts would boost economic growth enough to pay for $1.3 trillion in spending by 2027. But the tax cuts are also supposed to be revenue neutral, meaning that $1 trillion is already supposed to pay for the money lost from the tax cuts. Former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers called the oversight an elementary double count and a logical error of the kind that would justify failing a student in an introductory economics course, in an op-ed in the Washington Post. The idea that the tax cuts would pay for anything already was criticized. Over the years, it's been a reliable staple of Republican rhetoric about taxes that lowering the rates would lead to a boom in the economy that would offset the loss in revenue, but economists say the idea is often oversold. According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, for Trump's tax cuts to pay for themselves, the economy would have to grow at 4.5% over the next 10 years. That's 2.5 times the growth rate projected by the Congressional Budget Office. So what's the most likely result of Trump's plan? The nonpartisan group projected that the tax cuts would cost the government between $3 and $7 trillion over the next decade. These are the victims of the Manchester concert bombing by Kate Samuelson, Alana Abramson, and Joseph Hinks. 18-year-old Georgina Callender couldn't wait to see Ariana Grande perform at the Manchester Arena Monday night. "So excited to see you tomorrow," she tweeted at the singer in all capital letters the night before. But what should have been an exuberant evening quickly turned to devastation. As the concert ended, a suicide bomber detonated an explosive at the Manchester Arena, sending teens screaming for the exits, separating parents from their young children, and leaving scores of injured bloodied on the ground. At least 22 people, including Callender, did not make it out alive. As families searched frantically for missing children and teens on Tuesday, authorities began releasing information about the victims. In addition to Callender, they included an 8-year-old girl who had been separated from her family in the panic, and a man in his 20s described on a fundraising page to help his family with funeral costs as one in a million and loved by so many. Here's what we know so far about the victims. Georgina Callender. The death of 18-year-old health and social care student Georgina Callender was confirmed by her school in a statement published on Facebook Tuesday. "It is with enormous sadness that it appears that one of the people who lost their lives in Monday's Manchester attack was one of our students here at Runshaw College," it read. "Our deepest sympathies, thoughts, and prayers go out to all of Georgina's friends, family, and all of those affected by this loss." Callender had also attended the Bishop Rawsthorne Church of England Academy, which remembered her as someone who was well-liked and always seized the day. "Georgina was a lovely young student who was very popular with her peers and the staff and always made the most of the opportunity she had at the school," it said in a statement. "Our thoughts and prayers go out to Georgina's family at this terrible time, and we think especially of her brothers Harry and Daniel, who are also former students of the school. All of our students will gather together today for a time of prayer and reflection and to give thanks for the life of Georgina." Following the news of her death, YouTuber Joe Sugg, the brother of Zoe Zoella Sugg, one of Britain's most famous vloggers, tweeted, "So sad to hear about this. R.I.P. Gina." Safi Rose Roussos. Another victim has been named as 8-year-old Safi Rose Roussos. The child was at the concert with her mother and sister, who were later found injured in separate hospitals, The Guardian reports. Chris Upton, the head teacher at Safi's school, said she was simply a beautiful little girl in every aspect of the word. He added, "She was loved by everyone, and her warmth and kindness will be remembered fondly. Safi was quiet and unassuming with a creative flair." John Atkinson. A third victim was named by Manchester Evening News as John Atkinson, a man in his 20s from the town of Radcliffe in Greater Manchester. On a fundraising page set up to help Atkinson's family with the funeral costs and other expenses, Atkinson was described as one in a million and loved by so many. Atkinson also danced competitively for the Radcliffe Dance Troupe. The troupe posted a tribute to Atkinson on its Facebook page, noting they had lost a member of our dance family and describing Atkinson as a happy, gentle person. Olivia Campbell. The mother of 15-year-old Olivia Campbell, who had made several public appeals for information on her daughter's whereabouts, confirmed that she died in the Manchester attack early on Wednesday morning. "R.I.P., my darling, precious, gorgeous girl," Charlotte Campbell wrote on her Facebook page. "Taken far, far too soon. Go sing with the angels and keep smiling. Mummy loves you so much." In an interview with CNN, Campbell described a telephone conversation with Olivia as she waited for Ariana Grande to come to the stage. "She was so happy and she thanked me and said she loved me. That was the last I heard from her," she said. Olivia had gone to the concert with her friend who was celebrating his birthday. She loved music and liked to sing herself, her stepfather Paul Hodgson told CNN. Being at the concert was like a dream come true to her, he said. Campaigns to find Olivia surged across social media following her parents' appeals. An hour after Charlotte Campbell confirmed her daughter's death, more than 4,000 people wrote condolences on her Facebook page. Kelly Brewster, a 32-year-old office worker who was attending Monday night's concert with her sister and young niece, has been confirmed dead, multiple outlets have reported. Brewster's partner, Ian Winslow, confirmed her death on Facebook Tuesday night, saying, "Kelly really was the happiest she has ever been, and we had so many things planned together," he wrote. Other friends and relatives also took to social media to share memories of Brewster from Sheffield, England. Paul Dryhurst, Brewster's uncle, described how she shielded her sister and niece, who were both hospitalized, from the full force of the blast. The three were walking out in single file with Claire in front, Holly behind her, and Kelly behind her, he said, according to The Guardian. Allison Howe and Lisa Lees. Allison Howe, 45, and her friend, 47-year-old Lisa Lees, were waiting to pick up their daughters in front of the Manchester Arena when the bomb exploded. Their two daughters, both 15, are believed to be safe, UK newspaper The Mirror reported early Wednesday, but neither mother survived the attack. For those who don't know, Lisa is gone but never ever forgotten. I love you, Lisa. I'll miss you so much, Lisa Lee's brother Lee Hunter wrote on Facebook Tuesday night. Jordan Howe confirmed that his stepmother Allison Howe had died. They took a caring, beautiful mum and stepmother away from all of us. She was amazing to us all. Love you loads, Allison Howe, XX, he wrote on Facebook. Both women were from the greater Manchester town of Oldham and had earlier been reported missing by family members. Marcine and Angelika Klees. Two Polish nationals, Marcine and Angelika Klees, were confirmed dead by Poland's foreign minister on Wednesday morning. The York-based couple had come to the Manchester Arena to meet their daughters who were attending the Ariana Grande concert. The parents came after the concert to collect their daughters, and unfortunately we have information that they are dead. The children are safe, he said on Polish radio station RMF-FM, according to the Daily Telegraph. Confirmation of Klees' parents' death comes the day after their 20-year-old daughter Alex, a student at York University, issued a widely shared Facebook plea. "Anyone who is in any safe place or hospital in Manchester, if anyone comes across my parents, please, please let me know, as they've been missing ever since the attack," Alex wrote. Below the text, she posted a selfie taken by her parents. It showed them smiling in Manchester's city center shortly before they arrived at the concert hall. Martin Hett. The death of Martin Hett from Greater Manchester was announced today on Twitter by his boyfriend Russell, who described the 29-year-old as his soulmate. Hett from Greater Manchester was about to set off on a 2-month dream tour of the United States. Hett, who made a number of appearances on reality television shows, including the British favorite Come Dine With Me, sent his final tweet from the Ariana Grande concert. At 9:37 p.m. local time, he wrote, "When you sneak out for a toilet break on the Macy Gray song and the entire arena had the same idea, hashtag Dangerous Woman Tour." We got the news last night that our wonderful, iconic, and beautiful Martin didn't survive. He left this world exactly how he lived, center of attention. I'm in a really bad way, so please forgive if I don't reply. Thankfully, I have his wonderful family and amazing friends to keep each other strong. I love you, Martin. I always will. Russell. Late last year, a series of tweets by Hett received national attention when he shared a story of kindness directed towards his mother. His mother had set up a stand where her knitted items could be sold, but when she didn't manage to sell anything, Hett appealed to his friends on social media, and quickly her entire online store had sold out. Het's tale, which he collated in a Twitter moment post called How Twitter Fell in Love with My Mother. She was ready to give up on knitting altogether, but Twitter saved the day, went viral. Thanks for everyone's help and support. I will love him forever, Christina tweeted. This is a breaking news story and will be updated. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.